Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
I'm Joey Cohn, General Manager of KNKX.
Joey, tell me a little bit about your coworker across the hall, Winston.
He stares at me through the glass every day. I'm always wondering what he's thinking. You have to give him space, and it's all about Winston. So don't expect a give-and-take relationship.
Is he kind of surly?
He can definitely be surly. He's also very manipulative. When I first met him, he was very friendly. But over time, he became much more standoffish. But I'm trying to figure him out. I just want a kind, gentler relationship with him.
Our boss, Joey, he really means what he's saying. He wants to find some common ground with Winston. He wants to make this relationship work. By the way, this is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. To understand the full scope of the situation, you need to know more about Winston, this sometimes difficult office mate.
I'm Justin Steyer, and Winston is my, I guess you say, son or pet, depending on the day. And he's almost 4 years old, French Bulldog, roasted marshmallow color. And he loves everybody except for really Joey and anybody that tries coming in this office for some reason.
I love his face. He's just got this wonderful, cute face. He's really a pretty adorable dog. It's fun to take him for a walk as he runs. He's got these little legs that move really fast. It's almost like a wind-up toy. And he has super soft ears. So, you know, you want to pet him because he's just so soft. So, you know, what I want out of the relationship is just, you know, I just want to pet him. And what he wants out of the relationship is treats.
Do you remember the moment when he was a cute, cuddly puppy and then he turned?
Yeah, he went after my shoes one day for some reason. I don't know exactly. I might have maybe been doing a little, you know, like shoe thing. Not like taunting him with my shoes, but I might have done something. And it just set him off. He just went nuts. So it was a pretty dramatic moment.
Has it gotten better?
It has gotten better because I think I have a better understanding of him. I think he has changed over time. He's become more independent. He knows what he wants. But I will say he's manipulative. And I went online and read about bulldogs. And one of the personality traits is they say French bulldogs can be manipulative. And it's all about the treat.
Do you have any treats on hand?
You know, I gave him my last two treats this morning. So I'm all out of treats right now. It's kind of dangerous for us to even maybe approach him. See, did you see what he did as soon as he saw me? He licked his chops. You know, I mean, it's the Pavlov's dog
You're
thing.
You're just a walking biscuit, Joey.
I'm a walking biscuit. And now he's running back to his dad and he's barking. What's that about? I think you said, hey, man, people are outside. Maybe they're going to be taunting me, or this is making me feel defensive. You know, this is my territory. This is my space.
I'll open the door and let Joey feed me a treat.
Well, let's see what happens. And I don't have a treat on me again, I'm sorry to say. Hey, Winston, you want to come over here so I can pet you? Winston, come over here. Come over here. Good boy. Good boy.
Have you ever been able to scoop him up in your arms?
Oh, God, no. Oh, my God, no. That would be like, wow. He'd have to be heavily, you know, drugged for that to happen.
Today on Sound Effect, stories of relationships like Joey's and Winston's, you know, odd couples. We'll hear from the construction worker who befriended the little old lady whose house he was building around. We'll tell you about two brothers who are so different from each other, they have to settle arguments in a cage fight. Plus an essay about an ex-girlfriend with a dark side. These and more stories of odd couples just ahead on Sound Effect. Thank you. I'm in Ballard in front of this large development near the water and near the Ballard Bridge. And smack in the middle of it is a boarded up 1.5-story cottage. And it's a shell of what it was. It used to be brown with white trim. Flowers bloomed in the front yard. It belonged to Edith Masefield, the elderly woman who refused to sell to a developer, even though at one point she was offered $1 million for this house. She's been dead for 8 years now, and still her memory lives on, and she's become this icon of independence. Edith Masefield was able to stay in her house until the day she died, thanks to the help of one man, Barry Martin, a no-nonsense, spare in conversation, bearded construction foreman. Barry was in charge of these 5-story buildings going up around Edith's house.
And within 4 feet of her house is how close we were getting. And so I had to go meet her because she was going to be a close, a real close neighbor. And I've learned over the course of time that you want to keep your neighbors happy.
Again, our theme today on Sound Effect is odd couples. Barry and Edith, they were truly an unusual pair. By the time they crossed paths, by the time they met, Edith was in her 80s. Barry and the construction workers would keep an eye on her. He says she would always feed the birds outside here on the sidewalk.
But if by 10 o'clock there wasn't bird seed on the sidewalk, then I would go knock on the door and yell through the mail slot just to make sure that she was, you know, okay, not down on the floor and, you know, needed some help. And most of the time she would yell back at me and tell me to leave her alone and go away. And it's like, okay, well, I'm just checking on you.
One day, Edith started to let her guard down. She asked Barry to take her to her hair appointment.
She didn't feel comfortable driving that day. And all this time I told her, if she needed anything, I'd help her. So I have to say yes. And so I had a meeting that day, but rescheduled the meeting so that I could take her to get her hair done. And then I, you know, drove her over to Ballard, dropped her off, gave the hairdresser my phone number, and she called me when she was about done, and then I went back over and picked her up.
After that, Edith started asking Barry to take her to her doctor's appointments.
It got to the point where I made her doctor's appointments. I would come in early in the morning and make her breakfast. I'd either go get her lunch or make her lunch. I would stay after work, make her dinner. I made sure her laundry was done. I did all of her grocery shopping. I paid her bills. On the weekends, I would come out, and basically I'd stay the weekend because the only way that she was going to get food was if I made her 3 meals a day. You know, I live, 45, 50 minutes away. And so to spend an hour to drive there, come over and eat, or feed her, and then drive home for an hour and then turn around and drive back just didn't make any sense. And so most of the Saturdays and Sundays, I ended up, staying there for the whole day and, paying the bills and, gathering up her laundry and taking it out.
You have your own life and you're married.
Yep.
You have a family.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you do this?
It started out as little simple things. I started making her dinner because I went over one day after work and the dinger went off saying that her dinner was ready, and so she was going to get up and go get it out of the oven, and I said, I'll go get it for you. And I stuck my hand on top of the stove, and the stove was, 50, 60 years old. It was as hot on the outside as it was on the inside. And at that point in time, I'm thinking, she's frail, her skin is thin, she could get burnt bad. And at that point in time, I tried to talk her into getting a microwave. And she didn't want to have anything to do with a microwave. And so it's just little things, a little bit more, a little bit more. And one day I did wake up and think, oh my God, how did I get here? And what do you do now? Because now she's dependent upon me and she doesn't have anybody else. And so really I can't bail on her because that was always kind of her her feeling. And I believe that's the reason why she was cranky like she was, because I think that was a self-defense mechanism.
Explain some of the moments when she was trying to push your buttons.
Well, the biggest one, which really kind of made the breakthrough, was I'd gone to the store. I had gotten some fresh halibut, baby red potatoes, and sugar snap peas. And I came home and...
Meaning her house.
Yeah, came back to her house and made her dinner and brought it out, set it down on the coffee table. She looked at it. She looked at me. She grabbed the corner of the coffee table and flipped it upside down. And that really made me mad. Something hit the floor and I drop kicked it across the room and said, "Okay, I'm done." And she said, "See, I told you that you couldn't make it." I said, "What are you talking about?" And she says, "Well, you're quitting." I said, "No, I'm just going home." And I says, "I'll be back here in the morning." And she looked at me and she just didn't, she was expecting me to bail on her. And so I left and I made it down the road, a couple of miles, and my phone rings. And I answer it, and she says, "I'm hungry." So I turned around, went back, and made her something else, but it wasn't halibut. And there was, you know, quite a few things that I learned along the way from her that were things that I realized that we think we're doing it for them, but really we're doing it to make ourselves feel better.
Like what, in your case?
Well, the one thing was, you know, I wanted to get her a microwave because she could cook her meals in the microwave, not have to mess with the stove and worry about getting burnt. And so then I started realizing, well, you know, it was me worrying about her getting burnt. So I was wanting her to get the microwave so that I didn't concern myself with her cooking dinner and, you know, and getting burnt. And so, you know, I came to the realization that I was really wanting the microwave for me, because that would be, you know, something that she could do and I didn't have to do it. You know, there were just subtle little things like that that realized that it works just fine for her and she doesn't want to change it. And who am I to say that she's to change it?
A lot of people would have been done and would have walked away. Why didn't you?
Basically because I'd made her a promise.
Is this something that has been one of your traits throughout your life? We can depend on you if you make a promise?
Yeah, I was taught that, you know, when you die, people don't really talk about how much money you had or the things that you did. They talk about what kind of a person you were.
As they got to know each other, Edith and Barry found they had a lot in common. They were both no-nonsense and stubborn, but in many ways, they were also incredibly different.
She read a lot of books. She did a lot of writing, short stories, some that she actually got published, children's short stories. I myself never really finished a book, and she spoke 6 or 7 different languages.
Seriously? Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. She was a very interesting person. I mean, she had a lot of stories.
What were some of the most compelling ones she told you?
That she was a spy for the British government, and she was spying on Hitler. She was arrested over there and put in Dachau, and that she escaped from there with a truckload of children. I think there was 13 of them, I think she said. And so none of that was I actually able to prove. She told me that Benny Goodman was her cousin. And I actually found a photograph of Benny Goodman, and I also found an album book where there was like 4 different albums in the book, and he had signed it to my cousin Edith.
Mm. What went through your mind when you found that book?
That she wasn't as crazy as an old lady as I thought she was.
Did you love her?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, you don't take care of somebody day in and day out and feed them and, you know, help them get dressed and do everything for them and not have those feelings. I mean, I'd give her a kiss on the forehead when I'd leave. The first time I gave her a kiss on the forehead, she told me that her mother never kissed her. And it's like, wow. You know, nothing that she could ever remember. You know, so that was pretty kind of enlightening, you know.
Edith was 86 years old when she died at home. She had no living will and left everything to Barry, including her little cottage, shadowed on three sides by the large development.
I sold the house for $310,000, which worked out pretty good because it was shortly thereafter when we had the big downturn and I was out of work for a year and a half. And I invested the money, and the interest that I made off of that made my house payment every month. So Edith was gone, but she was still taking care of me.
After she gave you power of attorney and she passed away and she left you everything, did people question the relationship?
Oh, yeah. You know, there was lots of people that, like I said, they thought that, you know, I put things in the water, that I did something to brainwash her. You know, but all those people, they didn't know her. They didn't ever stop and talk to her or anything else. And so, you know, some days were a little tougher than others. But then, you know, once I got in my mind that, you know, the only thing that mattered was that, you know, she knew and I knew and my wife knew. And that's really all that really mattered.
That the three of you knew what?
What was real.
Barry has two framed pictures of Edith in his home. In one, taken a few years before she and Barry met, she's sitting with a cat in her living room, and that photo is in Barry's kitchen. The other photo is a portrait of Edith from when she was in her 20s. That one sits in Barry's den. Barry may not be much of a reader like Edith was, but he did end up writing a book about his relationship with her. It's called Under One Roof: Lessons Learned from a Tough Old Woman in a Little Old House. After our conversation with Barry, he went back to work, another construction site in Seattle. If you're just joining us, you're tuned to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. Today we're talking about odd couples. And this next odd couple, well, they're brothers. They're complete opposites and extremely competitive.
No. Answer the question. How else do you win the fight?
I'll take one of the two. I don't care.
Because those are the only options you have.
Sure.
Right. But let's talk about my options. I can just win on straight cardio. I can leg kick you to death.
These are the Fedor brothers. The quieter one is Karos. He's 32, a Marine Corps veteran. And the talkative fellow there is Ben. He's 27, and you might know him better as his alter ego, Phoenix Jones. Jones is the semi-famous real-life superhero who patrols Seattle in a rubber suit fighting crime. And they're both MMA fighters, as in mixed martial arts or ultimate fighting. They grew up together, they trained together, and they cannot stand each other. Earlier this year, they sat down with Sound Effect's Gabriel Spitzer. Older brother Caro said it wasn't always this way. They used to get along just fine until his younger brother learned to talk.
I think at the very beginning, at like birth, when he was first adopted, we were close because he didn't talk. And then as time went on, he's just such a character. You know, he's just the opposite of me. I'm super quiet and I don't like the attention on me.
And the irritation is mutual.
Carlos and I really didn't get along, like, growing up. Like, I don't even know how to describe that guy. He's kind of an asshole. I just don't know the right way to, like, because he's not, like, your stereotypical jerk. He's got his own little way of ruining things.
I should mention now that I've separated these two guys and interviewed them individually. We'll bring them back together in a little while. The Fedor brothers grew up in a pretty unusual house. Their mother ran a big foster home. Ben and Keros and their two other siblings are all adopted, and they had a bunch of foster brothers and sisters too. They describe their childhood as, well, kind of like anarchy.
I'd walk out in the yard with my friends and then get hit in the face with a paintball with no mask, no gear on, just get dropped. And my brother would be on the roof, like, sniping people.
Just a lot of fights, a lot of them. My mom would spend a lot of time, like, you know, crying and trying to pull us apart because we would really go at it. I mean, broomsticks, bats.
People need to think, like, if you were to let your kids go in the backyard and just do whatever they wanted to do, what would happen? And that's what our rivalries were like.
Accidentally stabbed him once in the hand with a pocket knife when I was like scaring him with it, but he reached out to like block and stuck it through his own hand.
Like, we literally set snare traps like you would find for like bunnies against like trees and stuff. And you walk in and get yanked up.
You're like, let's play Viet Cong.
Yeah, it was real different.
It was different. But I just want to interject something here. These two guys might seem like bare-knuckled brutes and everything, but there is more to it than that. Ben has long worked with kids with autism and with sick kids at Seattle Children's. Keros is a full-time caretaker for one of his mom's former foster kids who has intellectual disabilities. And honestly, neither of them really seem to want pats on the back for it. It's just that they have more than one side. But about 11 years ago, older brother Keros was an angry and kind of aimless military veteran who found his way to mixed martial arts. His younger brother, Ben, followed suit a few months later, and he found quick success.
Ben did well from the very beginning. He went on, like, I mean, he lost once, I think, but he had, like, 14-something wins, a lot of them by knockout, extremely exciting, and, you know, but then he started doing that Phoenix Jones thing, and then he kind of MMA went to the background. He wasn't his full-time gig anymore, and I think that's kind of where it's still at now.
He calls himself Phoenix Jones. To some, he's a protector to be hailed.
A blessing to this country.
To others, a danger to be mocked.
So let's talk about the Phoenix thing. What do you think about it?
I think he has good intentions with it, I guess. But, I mean, it's just if anybody was going to do it, it's so fitting that it's him, just with his personality. I mean, like, the comic book thing and superheroes, I just don't get it at all. I never have. I just don't understand it.
Ben/Phoenix basically dropped out of MMA for about 3 years. He was focusing on crime fighting and also his son and his day job. But then in 2013, he found himself pulled back into the ring.
I had fought a lot of crime, and I basically had a lot of legal trouble. I had legal bills. I had suit repair bills. I had all these financial bills. And I'm like, I don't know how I'm going to make, you know, like $5,000 or $6,000 super quick, because that takes a lot of working to do.
So Ben found himself a gym. He won some fights, made his money. But then things kind of went sour. He had a falling out with his coach, and he wasn't sure where to turn. And who was there to help pick him up? His brother, of all people.
That really blew my mind, man. Keros came at me at a time when I really needed help, and he came at me with open arms in a very, like, almost loving way. It was very weird.
He needed a place to train, and I was like, just come over here and maybe, because I mean, I care. He's my brother. I love him to death. And he needs to make money and have a future. So I was like, if he comes here with us and learns from the best, that, you know, he can do it. And he still could if he just would, you know, do it.
Keros brought Ben into his gym in 2014, and he helped get Ben back on track and trained up for a major fight in Tacoma.
The King of Sting!
3 months later, I got back in the ring with Keros in my corner. You watch the video, he's the most excited guy in the corner.
Ben Fodor looking for the choke.
Oh, short. Yeah, it's a matter of time here. And there it is. Ben Fodor, always dangerous.
He's the first dude I gave a big hug to, and he's like, you did it, you got this. And it was just this, like, I don't know. And since then, it's been a little different.
That fight was a big moment for Ben and for Keros. But it didn't change the fact that they still can't stand to be around each other most of the time. And that fight was nothing compared with the main event that they have in mind. A full-on, promoted, no-holds-barred cage match between the two brothers. And yeah, there's definitely some showmanship going on here. But, you know, you get Ben and Keros back in the same room talking, and it's clear there's also the kind of genuine animosity that might only occur between siblings.
If you guys get in the ring together, what do you guys think that fight is going to be like?
I'd imagine that we would just end up slugging it out and just actually fighting. I don't see it being too much of a technical battle. Like, our sparring sessions really turn into just kind of like two brothers really going at it.
There's just always been a little confusion over who's the better athlete and who's the better fighter. Like, you could win a world championship, and my mom would probably still think Karos could beat me.
What do you think the outcome would be?
I mean, technically, I'm better, and I could beat him, but I don't take the chances out of getting knocked out by him either.
Let's make no mistake. Karos is better than me at certain aspects of fighting, but he doesn't have the car to drive it. I drive a Ferrari. He drives a Mazda. And the difference has been that he's been putting premium gas in his car. I'm at the same shop now. I get the same gas, but I'm a Ferrari. You're a Mazda.
So I noticed you took out your phone when Ben started talking. How come?
It's just an easy way to deal with it. Just kind of tune him out a little bit.
Well, hey, you can't shut me off. We're here talking. We're having an interview. You can't shut me off. Really, how many championships did you win as an amateur?
Just a couple. Not as many as you.
Two, right?
So far, there's still no fight on the books. Okay, and for the record, they both say their mom would rather they not savagely beat one another. But there may be no avoiding it. These two brothers both still have something to prove.
So I'm not going to make you guys say something nice at the end of this interview about each other.
Cool. I will say something nice about Karos. You are a mirror that reminds me of everything that I hate about myself that I can't do. He's great at all the things that I'm bad at. Being able to take me and help me train for my fights and get me a world title, it was honestly an amazing gift and something that I couldn't have done in return. You know, I appreciate everything that he's done. This has nothing to do with that. It's not coming from a place of hate. It's coming from a place of just, I want to be the best. And once I beat you up and hurt you, I'm going to be the first person to pick you up and take you out to the bar to get a drink with my bonus cash.
What do you think about that?
I appreciate how he feels about it, and I love him too. And it's not going to change how we, you know, how we interact day to day, though. We're just completely opposite people.
Does that mean I'm good looking and you're not, or that I'm skilled and you're not?
Talking to Ben and Karos Fedor has made me think that for a real rivalry, the opponents really need to have something in common. If you didn't see yourself in your rival, how could you summon up that passion? So maybe, at their heart, all great rivalries are sibling rivalries.
That story from Sound Effects' Gabriel Spitzer. The Fedor brothers did end up fighting each other back in July. Older brother Karos defeated Ben in a unanimous decision. This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today's theme is odd couples. And this next pairing started off innocently enough. A regular boy meets girl scenario, but in time, the girl was not who she first appeared to be. She revealed a much darker side. And the boy in question, well, he's left wondering why fate brought them together. Vic Vogler is a writer in Seattle, and he brings us this essay. And just a heads up, it does include some sensitive language.
When my sister Katinka left me in Seattle, her farewell gift was date-stamped. 1 month with a lovely stranger. We had both moved to Washington to help our older sister Malvine, who would die of pancreatic cancer 7 months later. Then, Katinka, fresh from her own diagnosis, early-stage colon cancer, later beaten, said she was returning to California. Losing Tink, as we called her, blindsided me. Geography, death, they felt the same. I was closer to her than to anyone else in my family. Looking back, Tink's farewell gift to me had been a touchstone. Now it was an escape, an edgy rom-com I had lived. The opening credits rolled on a kaleidoscopic day at Pike Place Market. Tink and I were rounding a fruit stand when I saw a violinist in a red dress with short dark curls and Reese Witherspoon's chin. My sister saw a meet cute. "Drop a note and some money in her case," she said. Tink had inherited our mother's insistent cheer and weaponized it. No was no option. The pen I had ran dry, but an idea came out of it. "Hello. You play beautifully. Why two colors of ink? Call me to find out." She did, and her name was Yara. We met and chatted at an Asian market a few days later, a shy, snaggletooth smile dimming her wattage just enough. "Should we go back to your pad?" In Yera's smoky voice, the word already sounded like an in-joke. Soon after, sitting on my couch as a ferry crossed Elliott Bay, she led me further in. "Sing me a song," she said. There I was, back in Mr. Van Houten's eighth-grade guitar class, scraping through chords and lyrics, cataloging the girls I would never charm. Yera studied me with the same curiosity as when I'd left the note. This mattered. If music were her first language, I needed to conjugate a verb. My a cappella offering was "Don't Let Me Be Lonely Tonight," a James Taylor anthem of yearning. But don't let me be lonely tonight. I was 41, and Yera turned out to be 21. I know. But it was no stretch to say we both could have passed for 28. It was a fling, but sometimes even a fling wants to pretend it's more. She wept when I described getting to know my sister Malvine better before her death. Yera described getting to play a Stradivarius and how its sensitivity overwhelmed her. "I butchered it," she admitted. Even her red flags, if you squinted, snapped like colorful banners. Brushes with the law, men older than me, family fireworks. Troubled women had always intrigued me, or they nourished troubling needs, like the urge to rescue, that lance white knights lug into battles no one asked them to fight. One day, Yera suggested a weekend trip. When I planned one, she got skittish and broke things off. "You want a girlfriend," she said. "I can't be that." She was right, on both counts. But our month together had NyQuil'd the pain of losing my sisters. A few months later, Yera called upset over a problem with her own sister. I invited her over, glad to listen, but also thinking our history would return for a night. It did, and once more in the next year. But things had changed. Intimacy now seemed like the price for a comfort that she couldn't absorb. One night a few weeks later, I found Yera active on Facebook and suggested meeting again. Her response, even then, didn't surprise me. "Yeah, okay," she wrote. "I'm still a f***ing loser and I hate men." In a rant, she vowed to date only women and accused me of exploiting her lack of self-control. I said it was her responsibility to choose what she wanted. "If your intention is to lash out at every man you've ever known, I'm not interested in being part of it," I wrote. "My intention is to cut you guys loose," she replied. I knew I had it coming, at least part of it. That night, we both needed me to be every guy she wanted to cut loose. Yera called a few weeks later to apologize, but her intention had drawn a workable border between our past and a peculiar new acquaintance. Over the next 4 years, I would get sporadic updates about busking, Kabbalah, a cat she had to give up. In one conversation, Yera calmly praised suicide, shrugging off my pleas to seek help. Later, she embraced sexual fetish training and the control it seemed to bring. When we first met, Yera said she had been a third violinist. I had Googled her periodically ever since, hoping to find her name attached to a new symphony or philharmonic. Instead, one day, I found this. Woman says she killed former counselor because he was a creep. English needs a deeper word for shock. Light years from my own rom-com, the death of Yera's 58-year-old roommate felt like a remake of Fatal Attraction. Vodka, unwanted sex, a knife, hours of his wandering around without calling 911 because how would it all look? Strangulation, her effective surrender at an AA meeting. A history of trauma, DUI, and simple assault. Yera in an orange jumpsuit, curls smothering her shoulders. I scoured my memory for signs. Nothing in my time with her ever suggested she would hurt anyone, except maybe herself. My impulse was to take blame. The White Knight could have saved her, but dropped his lance instead. My sister Tink, aghast at her matchmaking role, joined the chorus of "Thank God it wasn't you." I insisted Yera wouldn't have hurt me. "But how do you know?" Tink said. I saw the knife at my own throat, felt sick, imagining the provocation. John, her ex-counselor, had been fired for, inappropriate contact with another patient about 6 months before. He invited Yair to move in. She did so on the day he was killed. No one deserved John's fate, but I had to cross-examine him. How could you exploit a woman whose trauma you knew professionally, whose life may have been in your hands? A blog post by Yara's father kept John on the stand. He backed up her assertion that the social relationship had begun while Yara was under John's care, and further alleged that it included training her to be a dominatrix for rent. Her father also filled in Yara's deeper past. A gang rape, suicide attempts, hospitals, lockdown facilities. He wrote that she was on Paxil when John bought her vodka, matching her public defender's statement that she wasn't in her right mind. It was tough to sort out the information. Rape charges were never filed, for instance, but the Bellingham Herald cited her case in condemning the state's mental health gap. Yara pleaded out and received the maximum of nearly 30 years. I thought of visiting her in prison, but I was afraid of the person I'd find and whether she would welcome me or lash out, as she had before. Instead, I imagined the trial Yara never got. She was at heart a decent person, I would testify, deprived of the help that could have saved her. The Stradivarius would be Exhibit A. Years ago, it had revealed the limits of Yara's ability, at least then, but also her ability to recognize those limits. There was power in that self-assessment, a sensitivity both wistful and strong, overwhelmed and overwhelming. In this way, Yara and the violin were equals. I would recount her prescription for me. Sing for 15 minutes each day. Not to get better, necessarily, but to wake up something better in myself. Even now, when I seek off-key comfort, Yara comes to mind. My testimony would conclude that, without trying to be, she was my white knight during one of the worst periods of my life. As for me, I'll probably always have a lance, but it's packed far enough away that retrieving it would mean stumbling over other junk. And the junk no longer interests me.
That essay from writer Vic Vogler. This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm your host, Jennifer Wing, and imagine you walk into a room filled with complete strangers, but everyone's there for the same purpose. They are there to snuggle up and to cuddle. These so-called cuddle parties, they truly exist. And maybe this is not your thing, and maybe the thought of snuggling with a stranger, cuddling with someone you don't know, makes you want to run screaming in the other direction. Well, you are not alone. It's definitely not for 88.5's Ariel Van Cleve, but Ariel is always up to challenging her fears and her phobias. So Ariel set out to take part in one of these cuddle events, and she's with us now. And Ariel, why don't you explain what these things actually are? What is a cuddle party?
Right. Okay. So a cuddle party is a space for people to gather. Typically, it's in someone's basement, their house. Nobody knows each other. They're put together by a facilitator, and it starts this conversation about consensual touch. And one of the big parts about this is that it is non-sexual. This is for comfort and for connection. And, you know, just because the word cuddle is in the title, it doesn't mean you need to actually cuddle. There's, you know, foot massages, there's back rubs, sometimes there's the occasional spooning. But really, it's also for folks of all ages as well.
Variations of cuddling.
Absolutely, okay. Yeah.
Why did you decide to do this?
A lot of good stuff has been going on, like a lot of external things have been going well. Got a good job. I love the city I'm living in. Got some good buddies. But then I started thinking, okay, let's focus on the inside stuff and figure out what's going on in there. And started to realize that one of my big troubles is actually people touching me.
Hmm.
And
when did this begin?
This is becoming a therapy session very quickly. I would say probably high school is when it really started presenting itself. So this has been a while. And I kind of hit a breaking point and decided that was enough. So I figured, okay, what's the most extreme thing that I can do to get over it. And turns out cuddling was the way to go. Yeah.
So the way that you feel about touch is kind of the way that someone who, say, is afraid of heights might feel if they're walking across a tall bridge or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's a good way to put it. In fact, my best friend, Andrea, can explain it real well.
I've studied you over the last 8 years, and I'd say that you are someone who is very a pleasure to be around, but you kind of keep people at arm's length.
Okay.
I think on an intimate level, like personal space, I think there's arm's length. I don't think it's like a 10-foot pole, but there's definitely a strong arm's length in there.
Okay, so she's completely right, and I hate that she's right. And it honestly, it really is a bummer having your friends know that this is a problem that you have.
Okay, so we need to clarify that you didn't actually go to one of these cuddle parties. Mm-hmm. You kind of skirted around the edge a bit.
I didn't go to one of the cuddle parties. I'm actually not brave enough to go to one of the cuddle parties, it turns out. But I went another route. There are these one-on-one cuddle sessions that you can do. There's this woman named LaShawna Williams, and she owns a business called The Cuddle Club over in West Seattle. And she is actually a professional cuddler. So I scheduled an appointment with her.
What was it like when you first walked in?
I thought for sure I was actually going to throw up or maybe run away.
Oh, Ariel.
I know.
That's a terrible feeling.
I know. But I knew that I had to go in. So I kind of let personal Ariel just shut down for a second, and professional Ariel grabbed all of her recording equipment and walked inside. I was greeted by this giant dog, this English Mastiff, just huge beast of a dog named Whitman, and I loved the dog instantly. But then LaShawna says hello and reaches her arms out and gives me this beautiful bear hug that was really nice, but I also really hated it. So that was a thing.
When you say you hated it, what was? Can you describe how that physically manifests in you?
I tensed up instantly, just real quick. And she could feel it as well. But I also tend to talk a lot when I get nervous. And so I was doing a lot of that, asking a lot of questions. And then finally she was just like, okay, let's go ahead and go into the cuddling area. And she just directed me toward this little room. And, you know, it smelled really nice in there. There was music playing. There was like bean bags, there was a couch, there was all this stuff. It was a very comforting place. So I started to relax just a little bit.
I bet LaShawna, she must have experience dealing with your type of anxiety and panic.
Right. Yeah. I was definitely not the first person that walked in and straight up tensed up as soon as she touched them. And she was actually telling me that all sorts of different clients go in there for all sorts of different reasons.
Sometimes it's people who don't like being out in public and don't like large groups. They don't meet people. So they're like, oh, I just want to hug someone. Just want someone to hold me. Sometimes it's someone after a breakup. I have several clients going through transition who are learning their bodies. Several clients who are survivors of sexual assault who are just relearning a safe touch.
It's very intense and important what she's doing. She's not forcing anyone to touch. It really is a matter of what you're comfortable with, what you want to do. It really is whatever works for you.
Sometimes I read. Sometimes we just lay there. Sometimes we talk about our life. A lot of sessions are silent. You know, a lot of it can be meditative for people. You know, sometimes people are crying.
Do you think you sort of met the opposite of you when it comes to comfort and the comfort level with human touch? Like you truly are at the opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of being odd couples.
Yes. And I think also that there's a comfort even in that, walking in and understanding that I could recognize that she was much more comfortable, much more prepared for this situation than I was, and just relaxing into that and knowing that it was safe.
Yeah. And so did you actually go through with this?
I did.
Ah, tell us about it.
So as soon as we were done chatting beforehand, I turned my recorder off, tried to make myself be present and in this situation again. For about 10 minutes, I was awkwardly sitting on the couch next to her. And then finally I was like, you know, I'm here. I got to do it. So I said, can I put my head in your lap? And she said, absolutely. And then she said, can I massage your head? And I said, Absolutely. And so we sat there, or rather I laid there, for 40 minutes, just talking, chatting, having a nice time. And she just massaged my head. And I just, it felt like a slumber party almost with a close friend.
Huh. Yeah. You had just met her.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So how do you think you did?
I wasn't totally sure. So I thought that I would actually ask Lashana, just because I had a lot of feelings as I was going through this whole thing.
I think in the beginning you were like, okay, I'm doing this. And your body was still like, oh yeah, we're doing this. And as the time went on, you relaxed into it and you could feel your body sort of say, we're here, and let go. How do you feel?
I feel super, super relaxed and like surprised at how relaxed I am. Just, you know, I was assuming that I would tense up, like I'd be fine with it, and then I wouldn't at some point. Like, that's kind of what I was waiting for. I almost want to pay it forward. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be going to bingo later tonight and seeing a lot of people. Mm-hmm. They're going to get touched a lot, which is going to be awkward for everyone.
You surpassed all expectations. Mm-hmm, that's great. It's been a couple weeks since you went to this official place and cuddled with a stranger, a professional cuddler.
Mm-hmm.
How are you feeling about all this now that you've had some time to reflect?
Well, I will say I'm glad I did it. I have definitely been considering going again, just because it's like a nice, slow way to get comfortable with the idea of someone actually touching me and get rid of this anxiety over time. I've become a cuddling ambassador in a way.
In what way?
I keep telling everyone else they should be doing it too. Everyone's horrified when I mention it. And then I say, oh, don't knock until you try it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want a hug right now?
No.
No. Okay. All right. thought I'd ask. Putting that out there. All right. 88.5's Ariel Van Cleve sharing with us her experience of going to a professional cuddler. Thank you so much for sharing your journey with us, Ariel.
Not a problem. Thanks.
That does it for the show this week. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Ali Ferguson, and Kyle Norris. Special thanks this week goes out to 88.5's Ariel Van Cleve and Gabriel Spitzer and Parker Miles Blom. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And if you'd like to share a story, you can send an email to soundeffect@knkx.org. Next week on Sound Effect, tune in for Island Time.
Whenever you talk to like your friends that are not single about wanting to date, they'll say, oh, honey, you need to import. And that is where you somehow trick someone off the island into falling in love with you. And then you convince them to move to the island. And therefore, they have been imported.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.